That was a little bit of Temporary Kings, the title track from the new album by pianist Ethan Iverson and saxophonist Mark Turner, both of whom are my guests on this episode of the Burning Ambulance Podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance Podcast. This is episode 26, and since I do one of these every 2 weeks, that means that this is our one-year anniversary. I want to thank every single person who's listened to the show in that time, and I want to assure you that year two is going to be even better. I hope you'll stick around, and if you want to support the show, please go to patreon.com/burningambulance and become a patron. The Burning Ambulance Podcast is part of the OSIRIS Podcast Network, which has over 24 other shows on a broad range of topics. One I want to particularly draw your attention to is Alternate Roots. It's hosted by Jesse Jarnow, the author of several books including Heads, A Biography of Psychedelic America, and the forthcoming Wasn't That a Time? The Weavers, The Blacklist, and The Battle for the Soul of America. On Alternate Roots, he showcases new independent music that's not found on Spotify or other streaming services. It's a great place to listen to jazz, folk, psychedelic jams, and music that doesn't fit any category at all. And he talks about all of it in a very informed and entertaining fashion. So visit OSIRISPOD.com to check that out, or any of their other shows that piques your interest. I've known both Ethan Iverson and Mark Turner for a while. Ethan actually wrote a blurb for a crime novel I self-published last year. It's called 50 Foot Drop, and you can find it on Amazon if you want. And a few years ago, I was hired to run a social media campaign for Mark when he had a new album out on ECM. Ethan and I had never met face-to-face, though, before this interview, which was recorded backstage at the Jazz Standard in New York on September 18th, the night they were there to perform songs from Temporary Kings. Temporary Kings is their first record as a duo, but they've been playing together for more than a decade, along with bassist Ben Street, in a quartet led by drummer Billy Hart. And obviously, they've both had very strong careers on their own. Ethan, of course, was the pianist for The Bad Plus for a long time, and recorded a trio album, The Purity of the Turf, in 2016 with Ron Carter on bass and Nasheed Waits on drums. He's also starting to build his own career as a writer, both on his blog and in pieces for The New Yorker. Mark has recorded as a leader for Crisscross, Warner Brothers, and ECM, and was, and maybe still is, a member of the trio Fly, and plays a lot as a sideman in all kinds of different contexts. He's actually got a second album of duos out this year. It's called Pharaoh, and F-A-R-O-E, and it's with guitarist Mikkel Ploeg. This conversation was really fascinating for me. We talked about each man's early career, about projects they've worked on together, musicians they both know, early influences, social media, and a lot more. At certain points, you'll notice that it almost becomes me and Ethan interviewing Mark, which I thought was hilarious but also really apt, because Mark is an incredibly smart guy and very philosophical in a really unique way. His attitude towards his life and career is unlike anyone else I've ever spoken with, and I'm really glad he was willing to be interviewed for the show. I'm going to play one more piece of music from Temporary Kings. This is Unclaimed Freight, and after that you'll hear my conversation with Ethan Iverson and Mark Turner.
Thank you.
So, am I right that you are, because I read an interview with you where it said you didn't have a piano teacher, so are you a self-taught pianist, or what was that just a weird interpretation of that statement?
You know, I had a piano teacher or a couple for a moment, but in fifth grade, I decided I really wanted to play jazz, so I thought that you couldn't have a teacher and play jazz. That was like based on some jazz histories I read.
Okay.
So during all these vital years when traditionally you sort of work on your stuff with a teacher all through high school, I didn't have anybody. So...
which is probably good.
Who knows? Who knows? But that's how I did it anyway.
Ah, okay. And so at what point did you go back to, you know, formal study?
I've always been able to read music pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
So during all those years I wasn't studying it with a teacher, it wasn't like I wasn't reading sheet music.
Right.
I was reading a lot of sheet music. And I went to NYU, I dropped out after a couple of years because I just saw the student loan adding up. I thought, what am I doing with my life? This isn't going to work out. And I knew I needed to keep working on something, and I heard that Fred Hirsch had a good way of approaching the piano as a teacher. So I worked with him, and then he sent me to Sophia Rosoff, who became sort of a lodestar in my life. And because I could read music, I kept on getting in positions just sort of as a handy pianist to have around. For my memoir, I have all sorts of interesting stories of all the people I played with in the 90s, not as a jazz pianist, as just sort of a workhorse pianist, culminating in working for Mark Morris and the Mark Morris Dance Group, and ending up actually playing, you know, European classical repertoire at a somewhat high level, at least a professional level. I mean, I was on stage in front of thousands of people playing the pieces anyway. But then more recently, I've been working with someone named John Bloomfield, who's really great as well. I mean, I guess I maybe have made up for the lack of early lessons by always trying to study on my own, one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the first credit that I saw for you on Discogs is Schoolwork with Dewey Redman from 1993. And that was like your record, and you wrote half the tunes. So tell me the story behind that album.
I came to New York in the fall of 91, and I hooked up with a couple of people who weren't actually at NYU. They were at the New School. It was drummer Falk Willis and the bass player Johannes Weidenmiller. I think maybe almost the first time I played with Mark, it was with Johannes Weidenmiller. They were both great, and for me, they were incredibly great to play with. You know, I had barely played with anybody, and they're super great. And we sort of had a little trio thing, and Johannes knew this guy at Mons Record who... it was sort of this moment where the technology exploded and everybody was making CDs because people were buying CDs.
Right.
And there was sort of some money sort of goosing this cottage industry of jazz records, which then became a deluge that no one could keep up ever since. But, you know, I think Schoolwork was sort of a little bit on the early side of that stuff, and I've been amazed at who's heard this record over the years. But my favorite band at, like, say, senior in high school or something was the Keith Jarrett American Quartet with Dewey and Charlie and Paul. And the Mons guy said, get a special guest, and Johannes and Falk love Dewey as well. So, you know, I had played a gig with bassist Cameron Brown, actually, and Cameron gave me Dewey's number, and I cold called him. Can't remember what we paid him, not enough. And he rehearsed with us one time and made the record, and it was my first exposure to an actual jazz musician. Because there's a pretty big gulf between all the people that play it at a competent level, especially connected to academia, and the people who are like consecrated jazz masters that actually speak the language like I'm sitting here speaking to you. So Dewey was the first person I saw up close and personal, and that really sort of changed my life. I think probably almost anyone who's in this music, if they don't have it growing up, they're going to have it some moment when they're actually next to a jazz master, and it's sort of like this revelation. It's like, oh, this is sort of how it goes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would say that probably everything I've been doing since schoolwork is an attempt to try to get some of that Dewey Redman vibe going in some kind of way. I called the record schoolwork because I knew at the time it was not a final product.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a work in progress.
Yeah, yeah.
A way to spend an afternoon making a record with Dewey Redman. Really no more than that.
Yeah. Now, Mark, the first credit that I saw for you was the Pontius Pilate's Decision album.
Oh, yeah.
Was
yeah,
that
right.
Was that your first record?
It was, yeah.
And how did you get onto that, you know, how did you get that call?
I got that call because, let's see what was going on. I was living in New York, and by the time the record happened, I was in Delphio Marsalis's band. But the reason I got into his band is basically because Josh Shedroff, then Redman now, who was in the band before me, not for very long, had just won the Monk competition, so he was basically done with that. And so Delphio needed a tenor player, and somehow my name came up, and then I joined the band, and I was working in Tower Records at the time, and I moved down to New Orleans, and that was the first time I was able to live off of music. And then we made a record maybe very soon after that. I don't know how soon, but maybe a month or so, something like that.
Yeah. So. Now, Ethan, I'm not going to ask very many Bad Plus questions at all,
okay.
But how did working with Dewey Redman early on affect your working with Joshua Redman 20 years later? I mean, like, mentally, because obviously they're very different players.
Now, Josh has become a pretty good friend and someone I admire intensely. But I would say, like, in the 1990s, I had a little bit of a struggle because of how much I loved Dewey, and Josh didn't really play like that, you know? So I've been around the block now a bit more, and also I have, as much as I respect Dewey as a tenor player, I don't know if, you know, his credentials as a father are in the same league, really. So I will say that I heard Josh play a solo unaccompanied saxophone cadenza at Dewey Redman's memorial. I also played at the memorial, and this thing was so beautiful, what Josh played. I liked Josh before, but I had maybe like a little question mark. Like, since he's Dewey's son, could there be a little more freedom and avant-garde in his playing, you know? And then I heard this cadenza, and I was like, that was incredible. I was so moved, like I was almost in tears listening to Josh play. And I think with the Bad Plus, since we are really, our model was the Keith Jarrett American Quartet as well. I think we brought out some Dewey from Josh that was really nice to hear. And I don't think he would dispute that if he was here. I mean, I sort of hate to speak for someone else like that, but we sort of talked about that. I think he enjoyed that experience partly because that was our reference point, and he could find that way in that style too, in a way that he couldn't with a lot of the other people he would usually play with, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Mark, you were on Jimmy Smith's album Damn in 95,
right.
And you got to play with Art Taylor
mm-hmm.
on that record. So what do you remember about that session, and what did you take away from it as like a learning experience? Because you were like, there was like a three saxophone section, and
right.
you all got sort of short solos on
right.
the tracks. So
yeah, I don't know what to say about that, because it was, you know, it was just a very quick session, you know, and it was great to feel what it was like to be around those two masters, but other than that, it wasn't. Yeah, it's hard to say. It wasn't as, it was fantastic to just kind of feel what that was like, but it wasn't long or, basically wasn't long enough to actually get something from it,
mm-hmm.
except maybe a whiff, you know, but that's
yeah,
about it.
Yeah. And Ethan, you made an album of duets previously with Martin Speak in 2004, and then just recently you did another record with him, which was a quartet, which was more original tunes. The first one was mostly standards, I think, right? Yeah. So what can you say about Speak and how your voices mesh, do you think?
Well, at least for my life, it just feels like it's a big circle, you know? So one of the really transformative things I did as a high schooler was I went to this jazz camp at Banff. Steve Coleman was the artistic director. It had Kevin Eubanks, Robin Eubanks, Kenny Wheeler, Rufus Reed, Stanley Cowell, Marvin Smitty Smith. And it was a whole month, and Martin and I were students there. And a whole bunch of incredible players were there, actually. Who's who of New York jazz people, Seamus Blake, Ralph Alessi, Tony Malaby. I'm going to leave out a zillion people, but it was a heavy year in a lot of ways. Benoit Delbecq was there with Steve Margolis. So Martin and I connected then, and we sort of stayed in touch. And right before the Bad Plus hit, like literally a month before, we made this duo record. And he wanted to tour it, but I had to turn him down because the Bad Plus had just happened. And then the Bad Plus ended, and Martin was like, you want to make a record and go on tour? And I'm like, I guess the time is right. 17 years later, let's finish what we started. So that's sort of it. I would say as a player, he's very melodic. And I actually love the melodic alto tradition. You know, early players that he loves too. Lee Konitz, of course. But, you know, there's a certain way that he has a sort of real... It's convincing when he plays melodies, and his tunes are good that way too. And not everybody can just sit and play a melody. You'd be surprised. So,
do you think you have a solo piano record in you, or is that not of interest to you?
I definitely have one, if not more than one. I'm still assembling the information. It's actually incredible to be out here with Mark playing duo night after night, because that's when you really get together. You can play all you want in your practice room, but when you play, especially playing with someone like Mark Turner, or playing tempos, or doing different things, I can already in four gigs feel things shift and get stronger in my playing, and I will definitely play more solo in the future and make a record.
Does the idea of long-form solo improvisation in either the Keith Jarrett or the Cecil Taylor mode appeal to you? Because it doesn't seem like that's your tradition, so I'm curious.
No, I like songs, and I like character pieces. In fact, I don't think I've performed as a leader any piece of music more than 10 minutes probably in my life. Maybe there were some free improvs with Tim Byrne, you know, that were great and went on all night, but I like songs and structures.
What about you, Mark? Are you at all interested in sort of unaccompanied, you know, sax improvisation stuff, like sort of the Evan Parker school of, you know, let's see where this goes.
I think I'm more in Ethan's camp, and I also like songs and organization. Not that I'm, you know, I like improvisation, but I'm less into soundscapes and more into narrative type of playing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On the record, we do get to hear a couple of cadenzas that are really beautiful and well recorded, and probably tonight there'll be some great solo saxophone moments. So.
Great solo piano.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll work on it. I'm working on it.
Goodbye.
I've seen you talk in interviews and in your writing, obviously, you say you know a lot about jazz and a lot about classical, including, you know, modern 20th century music, but you don't really know that much about rock or pop music.
Yeah, it's one of the great ironies of my life. There's a few, but that's up there. Yeah.
Do you think that puts you at a disadvantage in the era of Glasper and Christian Scott and other musicians, even old guys like Herbie Hancock, who are in sort of engaged with pop? Do you consider that as sort of a knowledge gap in a way?
I have two parts answer to that question. The first thing is, like, white pop and rock, radio rock, that's essentially my folklore. Like, if you grow up where I grew up, that's what you know, and I'll always know it. those songs come on the radio, it's like, I got that. I know that so deeply that I'll never need to study it, you know. Now, you're talking about essentially like the black music tradition, which is if it isn't jazz, that is not strong with me, and I would actually say that there's a whole side of Afro-Cuban music, all sorts of whatever you want to call it, diaspora music or whatever, dealing with the rhythm, it's a weak point. But it's one of the reasons I try to put myself next to Billy Hart and Ron Carter, that gives me an in to looking at it, at least from my vantage point, because I can't exactly go back to being 11 and dancing to soul music. As much as I would like that to have happened, you don't really get to choose who you are in this life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think for Herbie, he's a great one to talk about. I think it's always been very natural for him to be in the latest dance movement, and he's always had people around him socially who are very involved in that. You know, that's just, does Herbie Hancock have an advantage over me? Yes. Okay, I'll say it. He does.
And I've also noticed that you've been vocally critical of, I guess, what I would call 21st century music school jazz,
yeah,
which is something that I'm also strongly critical of.
Uh-huh.
Like, you mentioned Steve Coleman earlier, and, you know, he's someone who I feel has been literally a pernicious influence. But I'm curious why that's not your thing, given your interest in classical music and composition generally. You know, why this sort of everybody on the bandstand, including the drummer, has sheet music kind of thing is not your thing.
I mean, it's actually a subtle point you're raising, and I appreciate that. I don't think I've ever been asked this quite like this before, so I appreciate this. And also, we got to let Mark talk, because I'll just talk about it.
Oh, I definitely want to know what you think about
I'm
this, too.
Listening.
Okay, all right. But I would say Steve Coleman is, of course, a genius, and a lot of geniuses have this wild influence. You know, another perfect example is Keith Jarrett, who I know this music so deeply, and I love certain things very much, other things less so. But something like the Colm concert essentially gave us New Age music. And I don't think anyone who's into hip music sits around and is glad about New Age music, you know what I mean? Okay, so Keith has that on his record, and he knows it, and he's bummed. Keith Jarrett is bummed about that. All right, that's for sure. Steve Coleman, definitely a genius. He's sort of like the Schoenberg of jazz. Like, Schoenberg invented a system that was against tonality. And I studied Schoenberg. I mean, Schoenberg's in there, man. He's a genius. Steve Coleman's also a genius. But using it as a model, I don't know if it's even that much better than using the Colm concert as a model, because I think what the reason the legends of jazz were monumental 20th century figures that moved millions of people all over this planet was a mixture of certain factors. And I think you get in there with that music and you start being excited about taking out some of those factors. So you get excited about taking out democracy in the rhythm section. Oh, let's hand out some parts to the bassists and drums. That sounds like a great idea. You know, I'm into that because I'm now a composer. Forgetting the fact that John Coltrane, that's essentially the best music. Miles Davis, you know, if it comes down to like Miles Davis and John Coltrane being the best jazz, like, those guys never handed out a part in their life. So what are you missing, you know, if you're handing out parts? Of course, even I will hand out parts. Mark will hand out parts. You need parts for some things now. But that is just like the model. It's sort of easy to imitate, but it sacrifices some of the basic juice of the music, you know, if that's just your go-to. And the other thing is sort of like a blues ethos. You know, I would never dare say Steve Coleman can't play some blues. He certainly can. But all those people that follow him, can they sit and play a blues? Can they sit in and play a blues with some cats that can play some blues? At one point in this music, you had to be able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, like, Steve is sort of a way to, that template can be a way to get away from that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what's your take on that, Mark, and also sort of the younger generation of players? Because you're someone whose music can be regarded as somewhat cerebral, but not in that sort of way, you know? And I feel like there's a lot of players now who are sort of children of Coleman, but I feel like yours is also a strong influence, but not necessarily as obvious. So I'm curious what you see when you look at the landscape.
That's a hard question to answer. I mean, you know, I, in general, I basically been on the same page as Ethan is. No, there's actually not a whole lot to say after that. But I feel like there's too much. I don't know if that's true exactly now. I feel like that was more true maybe 5 to 10 years ago. Now I feel like there's a little bit of something else going on in schools, but basically a worship of proficiency, you know, which I strongly disagree with. But that's what it seems like is going on a lot of times. Maybe it's still, but it seemed like it was even more maybe 5 years ago, like a 10-year period start ending 5 years ago. But maybe there's still more, a little bit of it. But it seems like maybe a little less of it now. But just that. So, you know, the same thing by handing out parts to everyone and being if you're the most proficient, can read the best, play as fast as possible, play as many meters as possible, the most difficult thing, then there's nothing else to do, nothing, no higher place to reach. That's basically my issue with what's going on now. That's what it seems like to me. I might be totally wrong.
So,
by, for example, not handing out sheet music to the drummer, to the rhythm section, or expressing your musical needs by having, you know, sitting down with your band and just listening to something, or just saying a few words about it, can convey a lot more than just dealing with the notes on the page.
This question is for both of you, because I love asking this, because, and I'll preface it by saying that as a writer, I feel like there are certain writers you shouldn't read before a certain age. Like, you shouldn't read Hunter Thompson, you shouldn't read Bukowski,
nice.
You know, because they'll sit in your writing for 10 years. And so, what one influence do you think was the most difficult to absorb and make into a component of your own voice so that it didn't sound like imitation anymore?
Nice question, Phil. Wow.
Because, you know, you hear young guys, you hear their first album.
By the way, this is like, I don't know if I can tell the truth. That's like, it's pretty intimate. It's like, I'd rather talk about my sex life or something than actually talk about the influences that I took in deeply and then had to rearrange and, you know, have this complex relationship with. I mean, geez.
I'll go on first. I have no problem answering this question. That's kind of simple for me. I I'm not talented. And when I went and started playing, I just knew, okay, I can't play. And it doesn't matter who influences me. Even if I sound exactly like so-and-so, who I'll never sound exactly like, or even get close to it, I'm going to sound way better than I do now. So why don't I just start doing it? And basically let my own... Of course, I did spend a lot of time thinking about my influences and trying to rearrange them. And there's a 2-year period where I had a very hard time trying to figure out what to do about it. But nonetheless, you know, I knew that was going to happen. You know, we're all human, I'm human. I have, you know, thoughts and feelings and ideas about the music that will, if I spend some time and I think about it and figure out what to do about it, my influences will sort themselves out. But avoiding them is completely ridiculous. Thinking that I'm going to come up with something out of the blue and invent the wheel. So I just felt like I'm not really worried about it. You know, if I sound like somebody, then that's what I sound like right now. And I'll figure out how to deal with it. I'm not embarrassed by it at all. So, and the more that I delve into my influences and the past, the better I feel. And for me, the better I sound.
I know at one point you were like, you checked out Michael Brecker.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and absolutely. Like that's someone that
in high school for sure.
It's nice because I would feel like maybe some people would say I used to like Brecker, but I don't like him anymore. But I don't think you would say that.
No, I still like him.
Exactly. See, that's such so great. That's so
great.
Pure.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and that's actually I think. You know, I Mark's been an influence on me that way. Actually, you know, I think accepting who you are. Someone that's a bit like that for probably a lot of piano players is Dave Brubeck. You know, I got into Brubeck hard, man, when I was about 13. Time out. Man, that was like straight injection of time out into my system. You know, and I'd spent some years bummed about that later. You know, like I wish I'd been more into Bud Powell, you know, than Dave Brubeck. But now I sort of see it as that was cool too. And actually, I'll stand up for time. You know, I think that's actually a masterpiece jazz record. Is it flawless? No, it's not flawless. But, you know, Ben Street said something about that, too. He said he always still likes the music that he first got into. And I think that's...
Yeah.
I think it's the healthiest thing. If you can let yourself do that, it's pretty healthy, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Mark... I just read about this, that you had a very bad accident at one point with one of your hands.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, can you talk a little bit about that and how you sort of dealt with, you know, coming back and everything else? Like, what happened? Because I know very little about this.
Yeah, I just, simply, I was working on my house, and I had this large miter saw. It's a big round saw about...
I don't want to hear about this.
Foot and a half in diameter. Very powerful. And so I was cutting some wood. And this instance, I was super tired and just cutting some wood for my family, for firewood, actually. And then the saw is very powerful and just kind of sucked the wood into its... There's a little area that the wood goes into to be cut. Anyway, and luckily the wood stopped the saw, but my hand went with it.
Mm.
And so it cut the nerves and tendons in my in its index finger and the finger next to it, my middle finger. So, yeah, that's what happened. And then I went to a doctor. There's a long story about that, but basically I went to a doctor, a specialist, had a the fingers worked on, a little kind of a surgery operation, and stopped playing for 4 months. I had to do this therapy for 4 months. Basically, you have to move your fingers in a certain way every hour for 12 hours.
Okay, yeah.
For 3 months, and you can't miss. Otherwise, your fingers will be stiff for the rest of your life.
Wow.
That's kind of deep.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. Yeah, and I didn't know if it was going to work. They said that at first, the first person I went to said he didn't know whether it was going to work at all, and he may not be able to play again. And then the next person said, well, I think it'll probably work. So I got lucky. So that's basically it, you know. And obviously, I contemplated not playing it again. What would I do, you know? But you know, basically, in the end, you know, I figured that. That might happen, and I've been lucky enough to play. Most people don't, you know, it's a first world problem. Many few people get to do what they want for a living. So, anyway, for lack of a better speech about it, I just kind of did what needed to be done and waited to see what would happen at the end, and luckily at the end I was able to continue.
You, both of you played on Kurt Rosenwinkel's album Hardcore in 2003. I'm not sure if you were on together or not, on separate tracks or on the same tracks.
So which one was that?
Well,
it was
assembled
it was
in the studio.
Yeah, it was more of a studio
hardcore,
project.
Right?
Yeah.
So I never saw Mark. I did maybe one or two little things on that
no
record.
No one saw anyone.
Yeah.
It was 1% of the time.
Okay, but you played with him for several years before that,
yeah.
So... What would you guys say is the foundation of sort of your musical bond with him?
Foundation.
Well, how did you, when did you meet Kurt anyway? Like, when did that happen?
I met Kurt at school in Berkeley, Boston. But we didn't play then. And I sort of met him again in Brooklyn in the early 90s. And it was just at a session. There was a kind of a Boston house, is the best way I can put it. I think there were two. But there was one on Second Street where he and Jorge Rossi lived there, maybe. I don't know if Kurt lived there, but anyway, a lot of people from Berkeley lived in that house. And there were a lot of sessions in the basement. So we played a session, and I think he was looking for someone or some, I'm not sure what, but I think he was playing trio with Ben and Jeff at that point, and asked me to join and rehearse with them, and then we started playing, basically. But that was it, that one session.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was it? What was distinctive about Kurt when you first started playing with him, with Ben and Jeff?
He was just so lyrical, and his sense of harmony was directly connected with his sense of melody, which is not always the case.
Mm-hmm.
Intimately connected, you know, which is usually most of the time not the case, but. That was the first thing that struck me about him, and he was a great, is and was a great songwriter. Yeah.
He was another guy who was sort of really, really influential for several years there. I felt like, you know, a lot of people were sort of just ripping him off, you know.
Well, including me.
Everybody.
I mean, every instrument,
I would say.
I would go see Kurt and Mark and Ben and Jeff play all the time when they were at Smalls. Some of those Kurt tunes, I mean, in their way, they're just as important to me as anything by Monk or Joe Henderson or something. Like, I got to hear them live by this great band. It was a band language. But also, the songs are just so strong. The songs. You know? And the records are good. There's nothing wrong with the records, but I don't think none of them really capture what it was like to hear that quartet live. I still hold out for hopes that there'd be some Smalls bootlegs tapes that would come out someday.
There might. I wonder why there haven't been any yet, actually.
You know, because, for example, there was one tune that Kurt wrote called Alpha Mega that it never even came out on a studio record. And I've told Kurt, like, well, when are you going to record Alpha Mega? I mean, talk about a tune I ripped off.
Right.
I mean, the Bad Plus, I mean, Jesus Christ, we should cut Alpha Mega royalties, you know. But yeah, very influential for sure.
Mark, I saw you here with the Jonathan Blake Quartet doing the Gone But Not Forgotten record.
Oh yeah.
And
that
album and the performance here was sort of some of the most un-Mark Turner-like music I've ever heard you play. And so I'm really curious what your thoughts were about that, you know, that record and that band and what it kind of brought out of you.
Well, it's quite a story behind that, which maybe I shouldn't repeat on publicly. But, I'm not sure where to start, but I think I wish I had addressed the situation better than I did. On the gig and the recording, as there are a few elements which I won't go into here which made me less prepared for the situation that I would like to have been. It's a difficult situation to navigate, you know, especially standing next to Chris Potter, who's an amazing saxophone player. And when you play with someone next to that, you feel like you have to meet them on their terms and that you won't be met on yours. So, and I still didn't figure it out on how to stay on my terms no matter what the situation was. So, I think what it left me I was confronted with trying to figure that out. I'm still trying to figure it out. I think I've figured it out better than I had at the time, but I have a lot of work to do.
And Ethan, your album The Minor Passions, was that the first time you worked with Billy Hart? That was like your first encounter with him, or, you know?
I think it was more or less the first gig. We played a rehearsal, maybe, with this trombonist, Christoph Schweitzer. And it was sort of like Dewey, like, it was the first time I played with a great jazz drummer, was this little session with Billy Hart. And I just felt immediately like, this is what I needed. This was a missing piece. And I would do anything to get next to that puzzle piece to sort of try to get more of that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, Billy is incredibly open to working with young and dumb musicians. I mean, his door is open, man. You can call Billy Hart and he'll play with you. He played with me. It was amazing. You know, in retrospect, I'm like, what was he even doing? But, you know, I mean, it was great. And, you know, the little story, which is probably in print already, but, you know, after the Bad Plus happened, I could see it, that it was going to be a big deal. Like, we were essentially getting a big career handed to us, you know, sort of miraculously. And I wanted to stay connected to the best, more conventional New York jazz musicians I knew, and that was Billy and Mark and Ben.
Mm-hmm.
And so in other words, half of the Kurt Rosenwinkel quartet and my master drummer. So, like, almost right away, I moved in trying to do a little quartet hit, and then we played for Billy. He asked us to play a gig for him in his town, and then he was on the microphone announcing the tunes. We played his tunes, and immediately settled into an image that I think we all thought made a lot of sense, actually. And that band has been sort of going on all these years now, too.
Yeah, because that's since 2005 was the first record, yeah.
And, and Mark is playing with us next. We've had a couple of times Mark couldn't make it in the last years, and we've had to settle for Joshua Redman or Chris Potter or some of these other geniuses. But Mark is going to be playing with us next year, and we're going to be making another ECM record. In fact, going ahead, I guess I can probably say this, Billy's turning 80 in 2020,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to try to do some notable gigs and a good record and all that sort of stuff to celebrate him, because not just for me, not just for Mark or Ben, but I think for so many people all over the globe, Billy has been really generous and warm to, and showed them something about what jazz really is in his hanging out with them and his playing, you know. He has incredible goodwill on this planet. You tour with Billy Hart and people come out of the woodwork just to sort of be next to him again, because he's the real deal.
Yeah, yeah. It's so funny to me, because to think of him as, you know, this like legendary old school jazz drummer, because to me, he's always the drummer from Wandishi,
right,
in my head. Those are the albums that really got to me. And
sure.
So, you know,
yeah.
I always think of him from that respect.
He'll tell you straight to your face that he doesn't have it the way Tootie Heath and Jimmy Cobb and Louis Hayes had it. He feels like he's a little bit of a, you know, pop drummer compared to those guys. But, you know, for me, he's as close as I'm going to get to the real deal.
And how do you think the music has evolved over the course of, like, three albums now?
Well, I just think it's become more, well, definitely for myself, and I would think for Ethan, too, and Ben, we've all just gotten older, more experienced, mature musicians under Billy's tutelage, you know?
Yeah.
Probably that more than anything else, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think Bats made the band sound better, just that.
Yeah.
Right. Among other things, but that's the thing that hits me the most.
When you play with someone that good, you start playing better just in self-defense, almost. It's really true.
Yeah. And so I guess that leads us to the new record, which is very different from the quartet's music, obviously. So what was the genesis of this? Because your name comes first on the cover, so I'll ask you first. It says Mark Turner, Ethan Iverson, so.
I guess Mark's the bigger star.
Yeah, right. I think we know that that's not the case.
No.
I don't know how did it start.
There would be duo spaces in the quartet music.
Yeah, which would happen a lot. Duo spaces with any four of us.
Right.
So that had been going on anyway.
Right.
Actually, all these, free space ballad moments.
Yeah. And that always felt super comfortable to me, and
yeah.
I guess to Mark as well.
Yeah, I think we just wanted to continue that and then see what other material that we could bring about.
Mm-hmm. So did you write together? Did you bring in tunes separately? You know, how did it all sort of work?
You know, the book actually has more variety than the record suggests at first. Blush. I was talking to Mark about this, so I'll just say this riff again.
Go ahead.
I sort of improvised this riff in the car the other day, and now I'm going to repeat the riff. But I think one of the things about jazz, it's very hard music to understand, but there are people that sort of know how to make an image that scans, and Manfred has a real genius for that. And we had repertoire that we recorded that he said no to for the record because it wasn't in the style of the image enough. And then we have like what you might call rubato ballads, space ballads with free playing, and there's stuff that's more like in time and forms. And he sequenced the record and he put all the free stuff in front, and the tempo stuff comes later. And it's brilliant, because, you know, who even listens to more than the first three songs anyway? You know what I mean? It's when you listen to Temporary Kings, you're presented with this world that is sort of stays in this world for a while, and the lack of variety isn't actually a problem because it becomes a very clear image.
Yeah.
I was talking about two of my favorites are Steve Lacy and Mal Waldron.
Mm-hmm.
And like they just did the same thing every tune. There was no variety.
Yeah, it's the same as a pop record.
You know, right.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Very,
especially in hip hop records. Same
yeah.
Record.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
so
I think it's good for jazz to remember that sometimes.
Yeah,
you can
stay in the same vibe.
You can just stay in the same vibe.
Key.
I'm kind of blue.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar.
The first two tunes are like the same tempo.
Yeah.
No one cares because it's killing.
So I've never actually talked to someone about what it's like to record for ECM. So what can you say about that versus, say, recording for Crisscross, which you've also both done?
Mm-hmm. It's a completely different experience. Well, first of all, there's no, on Crisscross records, I haven't done in a while. You did one more recently.
Wow.
You know, there's no production, at least when I was on it. You come in, you have certain tunes, you knock the tunes out, kind of, in one day, and that's it. Pretty simple. The only thing that I don't think that happens anymore, but is that Tegans might ask for certain kinds of tunes, something like that. But usually, that's it. Really, it's really straightforward. Usually, there's some standards. But with Manfred, it's a whole other thing. We've both been on a few sessions with him, and sometimes he won't say much. Sometimes he'll get involved. But in that case, there is some producing and some suggestions that usually I find, I don't know if Ethan agrees, always make sense. Even if you disagree with them, I think you'll still have an excellent musical product. A lot of times people do disagree with him, but he knows what he's talking about. He has a strong sense for what will be musically balanced at the end of the day.
It's so great you brought up ECM and Crisscross, because I never thought of them in the same breath in my life until 2 weekends ago when I was playing with Dana Stevens, who brought up that he had the most number of ECM and Crisscross records in his collection. And it's true, they're both curated by a European, mostly American jazz, curated by a European with a certain taste. And they're almost like the complete opposite ends of the spectrum. Gary Tekins is hard blowing, swing, long solos, better play of blues, Ranford is very much the European classical side of things. You know, if there's no swing, that's fine with him. Maybe even prefers it, you know. And it's actually amazing how those two, like, complete each other. I don't know how either of them would feel about that comparison. But Manfred, I love them both, actually. I think Gary Tekins is a hoot and a beautiful cat, and God bless him. Manfred, I actually have a real connection with. I grew up on ECM Records. I fucking love ECM Records. I can't imagine life without ECM Records. And when I've met and hung out with Manfred, he's really a heavy hitter. He really knows what he's talking about. He's got perfect pitch. He knows so much. You know, a lot of people talk like, oh, I like some European classical music. This guy knows it. You know what I mean? He probably can play you some Bach on the piano, you know. He also heard the John Coltrane Quartet live. You know, he's been there. He's done it. He has real depth. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually pleased that Temporary Kings is an ECM record. And it, like, we went in there knowing we were making an ECM record.
Right.
I think maybe for some of us and about our age group, there's a, you almost want to fight it. Like, I'm going to go in there and I'm not going to make an ECM record. But it's like, that ain't it. You're not doing it. It's good to think of, like, Blue Note. Mm-hmm. Like, Hank Mobley didn't hire Rudy Van Gelder, and, you know, Alfred Lion hooked it all up, you know. Reed Miles hooked it up. All Hank Mobley had to do was bring the right kind of band in with the right kind of tunes, and they did everything else, and it was this thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And Manfred's like that. It's very special.
Yeah, yeah. And this question is also for both of you, because you were both part of the major label jazz infrastructure in the 90s and early 2000s when there was money just sloshing around. And you, actually, Ethan, you got to still be there when the money wasn't sloshing around the way it used to.
Wow.
Mark, you left Warner's in 2001, so you kind of just missed the crash. But what were your best and worst experiences being major label jazz artists? And by the way, I worked for a label. I worked for Roadrunner, which was a division of Atlantic from 2011 to 2014, and it was rough. But I'm especially curious to hear from you, Mark, because honestly, like, Warner Brothers was never really great at selling jazz records in my experience. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, you know. But from both of you, like, what was your takeaway from the major label experience?
Oof, takeaway. Takeaway in what way? Anything in particular you think about?
Like, you know, were you ever marketed in a way that really didn't work for you, you know, personally, or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's probably true, but I think I would have had to, which I wouldn't have known at that time because I was so young, I would have had to advocate for myself and say, you know, this is what I'm doing, this is the way I think my image should be presented, this is who I am, which at that point I wouldn't have known what to do, you know. So I can't really, I mean, maybe I could blame Warner because maybe that's what their job is, but maybe it isn't their job. I don't know. I can't tell. So, you know, the takeaway would be maybe if I was able to be cognizant of that, then I would have probably said, okay, I would have taken more control of the situation at the time. Because I think it seems like most of the labels, like any other label, like with pop music or any other kind of music, they'll see something successful and try to emulate that in somebody else. And they seem to do that with jazz to some extent too. I think Warner less than others, but maybe the music might be different, but they would still maybe market the person or an image in the same way, even though the music may not be similar to the previous successful person.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that model sometimes worked for them because they might get, you know, it's a little bit like incest or something, or a small gene pool. You know, someone might be very popular and they'll use the same methods, and they'll make money from the next person who would make less, and then the third one around, they'll do it again, you know. Because I saw that going on, I saw that happening. So I don't know what the takeaway is, really. Maybe the takeaway is it would be great if the labels could come back and we could do it a little differently. But anyway, that's all I have to say about it.
You know, I remember those records. I haven't heard any of them that recently, but I remember In This World, Mark Turner, In This World, you know, has an incredibly strong couple first tunes with Brad Meldow, Larry Grenadier, and Brian Blade. Everything's great on the record, but there's like those first couple of tunes are like, I mean, those are jazz classics. And mm-hmm. if you're like into jazz, you've studied it, maybe you play it, and you know that record. And then Dharma Days with Kurt, Reed Anderson, and Nasheed Waits, I actually think it has more of the sparkly energy of one of those Kurt gigs, more than the Kurt records of that period did. It was, I'm actually saying Reed and Nasheed are stronger than Ben Street and Jeff Ballard. That's really not what I'm saying. But there's just something a little more open and loose, and
sure.
stuff is, the molecules are popping on Dharma Days in a nice way. And Kurt's records are also really good too, The Next Step and stuff, but it's a little more contained in a way that I don't remember the gigs being. So anyway, one man's opinion about two of Mark's Warner Brothers records.
And it's funny because that band is the same, the first band that you mentioned is the same band that was on Josh's album Mood Swing.
Right.
Red and Brian
they,
and
you know, they were kind
Mark.
Of a right. kind of a unit at that point, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's yeah.
true.
So
For myself and the major labels, I mean, Columbia, the three records, the Bad Plus, Columbia was incredible. I mean, also, I still love Yves Beauvais. I'm not in touch with him all the time, but I see him, and I'm just thrilled. He's the A&R guy that signed us. He's the guy that the Ornette Coleman box, such a beautiful job for Atlantic. The beauty's a rare thing, and he did the Led Zeppelin box for Atlantic, a really beautiful box. And so that was always sort of our talking point is, you know, he did, like, if you want to know what goes into the Bad Plus, it's Ornette Coleman and Led Zeppelin. And I did, as we sort of already discussed, I didn't know anything about rock music from a real professional standpoint. And Dave King was like, you know, let's get Chad Blake. I'd never heard of Chad Blake. I don't, probably no one in my jazz community had heard of Chad Blake. Dave was like, let's get Chad Blake. I'm like, sounds great, Dave. Let's do it if we can. Turns out he's this heavy-hitting rock engineer. And the three records we made with England and Chad Blake, they have a sound. You know,
mm-hmm.
that thing when I'm talking about an image. There's an image there. And truthfully, in dormitories, the kids could put it on their playlist and it wouldn't bust up the vibe. You know, I think that's sort of like the way maybe some of Kamasi Washington's does like that hip-hop production for his thing, even though they're just playing sort of jazz, it doesn't bust up the vibe. If you listen to hip-hop and the epic comes on, it's sort of like there's like some sort of the frequencies correlate. So
his stuff is so interesting to me because he studied arranging apparently with what's his name, Gerald Wilson in Los
right.
Angeles, Kamasi, and he does all his own string arrangements and all his own production and stuff, and I feel like that, you know, the robes hide the fact that the guy actually really knows what he's doing behind the board as much as, you know, anything else.
Right.
For me, the production is the strongest aspect of those albums. And I'm sure I have haters out there that think the production of the Bad Plus album was the best thing about those, too. But I'll stick up for that production because it knocked me on my socks when I heard it. I didn't know what I was getting into, man. I was there in Peter Gabriel's fucking Real World studio with this legendary engineer. I didn't tell him a thing. And those records really sound special. They really sound different, you know. And the sad coda was that just so long ago, the details are a little hazy, but for our third record, I mean, the sales were tanking right away, of course. We had this breakout surprise hit buzz sort of thing, and we sold a lot of records of These Are the Vistas, and much less of the second and much less of the third, but the third wasn't helped by the fact that they put this copyright protector software on it. It's if only for Microsoft, I think, and if you tried to burn the CD, you had to sign up for this thing that would potentially give hackers a back way into your computer. And it was this huge scandal, and that was, they would have dropped us anyway, but in the wake of all of that, you know, it was like it was sort of a mutual decision, like, not to continue. But I'm proud of lots of things we did after that in the Bad Plus, but I do think those, I mean, the major label system, it's great when it works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was incredible what happened for us, you know.
Yeah.
But it doesn't always work.
Yeah.
And I think it actually, for jazz, you need someone like a Manfred Eicher or an Alfred Lion, someone who's in the music for the right reasons and just has a combination of telling the musicians to shut up just enough, you know, but not too much.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I've been around producers so often, they say exactly the wrong time. They say the wrong thing at the wrong time psychologically. You know, Manfred hasn't really done that when I've been around him. You know, he's super friendly and, like, fun, you know?
I agree.
I guess he lowers the boom once in a while, but, you know, I think Alfred Lyon, too, you know, he sort of got the vibe going with everybody in the right way and did what he could to massage that vibe into the right kind of session for their label.
Now, Mark, Ethan is very much like a public social media figure, and you are very much not. And I'm wondering if you ever feel like...
Sorry, Mark.
Why are you sorry? It's awesome.
I'm wondering if you ever feel like you missed opportunities by not going on Twitter and Facebook and not sort of marketing yourself more.
I'm sure I have. I'm sure I'm missing them every second. Yeah, I mean, I know that I should, and I just can't get myself together to do it. I mean, it just seems like it just takes too much. I have certain priorities, and I have only enough energy to do those, and by the time I'm done with all of them, then, like, getting involved with making sure I say something on Twitter, or put something on Facebook, or whatever this other one is, I forgot the name of the other one that everyone's doing.
Instagram.
No.
Photos, yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, I just can't imagine getting that. So anyway, can't do it. So I started, you know, getting someone to do some things for me. The other thing, I noticed, like, a lot of younger musicians are especially involved with Instagram, and it seems like on tour with them, it's just hard for me to imagine, like, interrupting my life all the time to make sure that it's always on a device. I can't fathom that. Maybe you guys can. But,
yeah.
You know, like every half hour, wait a minute, and then some picture happens during rehearsal, during the gig. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's worth it, though. Tell me, Ethan. What's the deal? What should
life? You know, leaving the Bad Plus, I've been so panicked about everything, I thought I'd better just make sure my social media presence was there. You know, I joined Facebook last year. I held out against that forever. And I just joined Instagram, too. I guess it's just like, if you just use whatever you can to try to make a few people come to the gig, you know?
Yeah,
yeah.
You're absolutely right.
But
yeah.
I think that I'm grateful that I had so many years of not having any of it. You know, like, if I was a high schooler with that stuff, I mean, I was so distracted and crazy in high school anyway. Like, if I had the iPhone too, I mean, geez, good Lord, you know?
Okay, that was my conversation with Ethan Iverson and Mark Turner, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you'll come back for the next one.
Osiris.